This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tom Pinkney. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Kamala Harris delivered an aggressive 1-2 attack on the character and performance of U.S. President Donald Trump Wednesday as they made their election case for the first time as running mates. Biden pitched Harris, his former primary rival, as smart, tenacious, a figure who will help him defeat Mr. Trump in November amid the pandemic, a cratering economy, and national reckoning on racism. Harris is making history as the first black woman on national major party ticket. Many Democrats see her as an appealing progressive mainstream liberal. Some independents and Republicans are unhappy, or for those who aren't happy, with U.S. President Trump. The president and his allies are attempting to cast Harris as too left-wing for the country. One Trump-Pence campaign email describes her as the meanest, most horrible, most disrespectful, most liberal of anyone in the U.S. Senate. Without providing specifics, it describes both Biden and Harris as two corrupt career politicians and urges voters to support the Trump-Pence ticket. The United States military reported that Wednesday, Iranian forces boarded a civilian vessel in international waters in the Gulf. The U.S. Military Central Command released a grainy black and white video on Twitter showing a helicopter near a large ship with the message saying, "Today in international waters, Iranian forces, including two ships and an Iranian Sea King helicopter, overtook and boarded a ship called the Wyla." According to tracking data, Wyla is a Liberian-flagged oil tanker and was currently anchored near United Arab Emirates port. A U.S. official speaking on condition of anonymity said the incident took place near the Strait of Hormuz and the ship was eventually released by Iranian forces. Tensions between Iran and the United States increased last year following a series of incidents involving shipping in and near the Gulf. This is VOA News. The top U.S. commander for the Middle East is warning that elements of the Islamic State group are working to rebuild in western Syria, where the U.S. has little visibility or presence. General Frank McKenzie says conditions in the region west of the Euphrates River are as bad or worse than they were leading up to the rise of the Islamic State. McKenzie also warns that the coronavirus has complicated efforts to move people out of a refugee camp or camps in Syria. There are more than 747,000 recorded deaths globally from COVID-19. The United States accounts for approximately 166,000 of them. There are more than 20,500,000 infections globally, and together, the U.S., Brazil, and India account for more than half of them. U.S. President Donald Trump is touting the success of the U.S. economy amid the coronavirus pandemic as he pointed to a series of charts in the White House saying the virus-induced economic contraction in the United States has been far less severe than it was with our peers and peer nations. Mr. Trump projects that the U.S. economy would recover quickly in so-called V-shape rather than a more prolonged downturn. The pandemic has taken a particularly heavy toll on the United States, which leads the world in coronavirus-related deaths and infections, followed by Brazil. Millions of U.S. workers have lost jobs as a result. Chile has lifted one of the world's longest quarantines, moving the capital Santiago Central Business District and adjoining Central Station to a transitional stage under a step-by-step reopening. The country has faced one of Latin America's fiercest coronavirus outbreaks, but case and fatality rates have declined steadily over the last 2 months. People may leave their homes on weekdays without the previously required police permissions and meet in small groups while businesses can gradually reopen. The government started to reopen the capital city 2 weeks ago by lifting the lockdown in suburbs to the east and south. Well, Disney World actors who argued that the Florida theme park's proposed coronavirus safeguards were inadequate to protect them and resolved a dispute over COVID-19 testing, according to a union statement. The Actors' Equity Association had called on Walt Disney companies to provide regular coronavirus testing for its members who cannot wear protective masks while performing as other park employees do. Disney agreed to provide space just outside Walt Disney World in Orlando for a state-run testing site. The union and the company said the Florida Division of Emergency Management will operate that location. It will be open to Disney employees known as cast members, as well as the public. Find more at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya is among countries to test a new WHO-approved COVID-19 vaccine.
Kenya is very close to become part of the WHO Solidarity Trial. Approval for this trial is near completion. And as soon as that is completed, the trials will also start in Kenya.
There are competing rallies today in Ivory Coast for and against President Ouattara's bid for a third term. A UN special envoy sees hostile atmosphere of mistrust in Guinea-Bissau. Vote counting is underway in Wednesday's Egypt senatorial election. And Liberians want to know who leaked Vice President Jewel Howard Taylor's health information.
According to what we gathered, the minister hand-delivered the letter to the vice president, and also a copy was sent to the executive mansion. We're not sure between the vice president and the executive mansion where the letter got leaked out.
An official South Africa's ruling ANC calls for a resolution of Zimbabwe's political crisis, and a new investigation sees a connection between some French institutions and slavery. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya will be among 70 countries that will participate in a World Health Organization-approved COVID-19 vaccine trial, according to WHO Kenya representative Rudy Eggers. This comes as Kenya is recording high numbers of COVID-19 positive cases and deaths. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking in Nairobi, Kenya's World Health Organization representative Rudy Eggers said that Kenya has been selected among other African countries where the COVID-19 vaccine will be tried. Eggers said that already the vaccine is near completion and will be available to Kenyans very soon.
Kenya is very close to become part of the WHO Solidarity Trial. So this is a trial where more than 70 countries of the world participate in comparing the different treatment modes that are available to us in a global setting. Approval for this trial is near completion, and as soon as that is completed, the trials will also start in Kenya.
A day after Russia announced the COVID-19 vaccine, the Kenyan government has said that it will initiate talks with Russia with the possibility of acquiring the vaccine, as the World Health Organization is yet to qualify Russia's vaccine. Chief Administrative Secretary, Ministry of Health, Mercy Mwangangi, said that Kenya, through Ministry of Foreign Affairs, will try out the vaccine and see if it is effective.
We, through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, shall engage to find out, you know, what exactly vaccine has been deployed. Is it working? It becomes important always, every time you have a new vaccine, to test it. And I'm sure Russia itself is probably going to be conducting studies, even as they deploy their vaccine, to ensure that it is actually effective. Back here at home, we are very proud of our scientists. Yes, Kenya is participating. We're in the second phase, and we have teams that are working.
Kenya's Ministry of Health yesterday, Wednesday, announced 18 deaths and 679 new COVID-19 cases, bringing the total number of deaths to 456, as well as 28,104 positive cases, respectively. However, World Health Organization says that most African countries have less numbers because of incapacity to carry out massive testing. Mr. Eggers said that 10 countries in Africa account for 89% of COVID-19 new cases, and that underreporting has made many African countries not to combat the virus in good time.
In the African region, more than 1 million cases and over 17,000 deaths have been reported. Across the continent, the COVID pandemic has taken varied trends. 10 countries in Africa account for 89% of new cases. However, the lack of adequate testing leads to underreporting of COVID cases and prevents the full understanding of the pandemic in Africa.
According to Mr. Eggers, WHO and other United Nations bodies have formed Global Procurement Consortium to help African countries get testing kits so they can manage the pandemic. WHO says the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted services in healthcare facilities, and that most patients with pre-existing conditions are not accessing healthcare services in hospitals. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
It appears there is confusion in Liberia over who leaks the health information of Vice President Juwa Howard Taylor. As we reported yesterday, Wednesday, the vice president was flown to Ghana on Tuesday to seek additional medical care for respiratory complications. Yesterday, a letter purportedly signed by Minister of Health Willemina Jala revealed that Vice President Howard Taylor tested positive for COVID-19 on August 10 and requested to travel out of the country for treatment. Reached by social media, both Health Minister Jala and Information Minister Eugene Nnamdi initially agreed to speak to VOA, but were not immediately available for the interview. Rodney Sie, the publisher of Liberia's front-page Africa newspaper, says Liberians want to know who leaked Vice President Juwa Howard Taylor's health information.
Well, James, on Wednesday, we gathered that the letter that came out from the Minister of Health to the minister's office, signed by her, indicating that the Vice President Juwa Howard Taylor tested positive for COVID-19, is a legitimate letter. Now, there's been a lot of confusion, especially on social media, since the letter leaked out. We got a copy before it went on social media, and we're trying to get authenticity from the Ministry of Health. And we're finally confirmed to us that, yes, indeed, it was letter, but they're confused about how it leaked out. According to what we gathered, the minister hand-delivered the letter to the vice president, and also a copy was sent to the executive mansion. We're not sure between the vice president and the executive mansion where the letter got leaked out. As you know, there's a lingering strain between the president and the vice president for months now. So the country right now is in a state of uncertainty regarding how the letter got out.
Rodney, the memo does not have a title. It just says to whom it may concern. So I'm wondering, to whom did the health minister write this memo? To the president or to the finance minister?
Well, we understand that the letter, because before you travel, you have to get clearance from the Ministry of Health. I mean, if you have tested positive for the virus. And that's the protocol. And so I think the letter was actually, according to what we gathered from the Ministry of Health people, that the letter was hand-delivered to the vice president. A copy was given to the executive mansion. And so I believe it was intended for the vice president.
What can you tell us, Rodney, about the Liberian News Agency? The agency came out last night on social media citing unconfirmed reports that the vice president had tested positive. Now, on Wednesday, the agency is apologizing to the public for what it called inaccurate reporting. What is happening?
Well, I think what is happening, James, is simple. As I told you before, there's been lingering strains between the president and the vice president. Lena is supported by the executive branch, including the president's office. So when the report came out from the agency, it sparked an uproar that perhaps the executive branch deliberately leaked information to Lena. But as we are seeing now, it appeared that it backfired, and so they had to cover their tracks. They issued an apology later on saying that they've taken action against the editor who put the story out. But people are not sure whether those reports were put out without the knowledge of the head of Lena.
The director of the National Health Institute was suspended by President George Weah over his alleged handling of COVID-19 test results. Is it likely, Rodney, that someone else or more people would probably lose their jobs because of what's going on with the vice president's COVID-19 test?
Well, more than likely that's going to happen because, as you may recall, earlier in the year when COVID was rampant in the country and around the world, there was an issue where there were reports about leaks, including even the president, who told that his tests were leaked out to the public. That triggered the National Security Agency to question staffers of the National Public Health Institute. And there was a lot of noise about who leaked out the president's test results to the public. And so the whole thing is being a state of confusion right now because no one knows what to believe, no one knows what to think. Everybody's on edge right now because they're not sure how the process is being handled by the government and the the Minister of Health and the National Public Health Institute of Liberia.
Rodney Sear is publisher of Liberia's front page Africa newspaper. You are speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. There will be competing political rallies today, Thursday, in Ivory Coast, as that country gears up for presidential and parliamentary election in October this year. On the one hand, the youth of former President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party will stage a demonstration against President Alassane Ouattara's decision to seek a third term, something that the opposition says violates the constitution. The youth union of the ruling RHDP will also stage a counter-protest in support of President Ouattara's decision. The FPI has picked former President Gbagbo as its candidate in the October election, but Gbagbo is holed up in Europe. Jean-Gervais Chaïdé, FPI Vice President for Finance and Budget, says former First Lady Simone Gbagbo has asked President Ouattara to give Mr. Gbagbo amnesty.
As the past president of the Republic, he has the right to detain a diplomatic passport. So she's asking the government of Côte d'Ivoire to give her husband a diplomatic passport. If the government refuses to give it is a violation of his rights, and it is against the national reconciliation. And she is reminding Mr. Ouattara that when he was in exile, it was Mr. Gbagbo, he gave him a diplomatic passport to let him come into the country. So he has the right to do so as the head of state.
How true is it that the youth of Mr. Gbagbo's party are planning a demonstration?
Yeah, that is true. Yesterday, they had a gathering in the headquarters of the party with youth of other parties, and they have decided to demonstrate Thursday, the 13th of August. They are demonstrating to ask Mr. Ouattara not to run for a third term. So this is what they are in every big city of the country tomorrow. If things go to the right way, we should have demonstrations in the main cities of the country tomorrow of the youth of the different parties.
Are you not concerned about the possibility of clashes or violence? Because we understand that the ruling party youth are also planning a protest or demonstration in support of President Ouattara's decision to run for a third term.
Well, if there are confrontations, well, this is the responsibility of the ruling party. Because before Mr. Ouattara decided to announce his decision to run for the term, the youth of his country, of his party, was in the streets. And there were demonstrations to support and to ask him to run for the third term. Nobody came out to oppose to them. How come that now they are willing to come out and create conditions for riot and trouble? So this is the responsibility of the ruling party of the government, and we hope that they will protect the demonstrators and they will not throw the young people against our youth.
So your candidate, you do have a candidate to stand for the election?
Yeah, for sure. We have decided that Mr. Gbagbo would be our candidate. Now it is up to him to say if yes or no, he will run for the term. But we have decided as a party here to ask Mr. Gbagbo to be our candidate.
Thank you very much, sir. It's always nice to talk with you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jean-Gervais Chaïdé is Vice President for Finance and Budget of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 13th. A United Nations special representative in Guinea-Bissau described a hostile atmosphere of mistrust in the country months ahead of the scheduled end of the UN Integrated Peace Building Office in Guinea-Bissau. The head of the office, Rosine Sori Koulibaly, has warned of tensions in the West African country. Dionisio Pereira, head of the youth organization of the ruling PAIGC, tells Ricky Schreier he disagrees with the UN report and thinks that the country needs a new peace-building approach.
I think it's better for them to leave the country because UNUCBIS are in Bissau for 20 years, but nothing is getting better. I think it's better to look for another solution.
What do you think those solutions could be with the continued standstill that, yes, this recent election in December caused some standstill, but also, you know, there were 5 years of standstill before that?
I think the solution now is like we need a really transition, because what is the problem now? No one trusts each other. The political the political actors in Bissau, no one trusts each other. That means that it's very impossible now for any part to lead the country. The solution to help Bissau citizens is not politician, but to help Bissau citizens, I think it's put everybody together like a transitional government and then define a roadmap what is going to take place.
But if the UN is not there, and as you've said, the political leaders as they are at the current moment of the country cannot decide who should come together to work, who do you think should, you know, bring together this transitional government?
Guinea-Bissau is a little bit different from some country in West Africa, because we speak Portuguese, our system is different. I think it's more important to for the country that speak Portuguese, like Brazil, like Portugal, Angola, that we share almost the same culture, the same language, and the same system. They understand more deeply than any country in ECOWAS.
What is the feeling of the youth right now?
You see, in Bissau, we have lots of problems. The things are mixed. First, we have a part of the population don't believe that COVID-19 is real. We have this problem. A part of the population don't believe. Another problem is that those that believe that COVID-19 is real, but they don't have a structure to avoid COVID. So many young people, they are in an employment situation. They are not working. They are supported by the family or others. There is no infrastructure. There is nothing that can help them to protect. And our political situation and the economy is going down day by day. And the situation is not so good. We have, in terms of this generation, they don't trust now the another generation that are leading the country. And then I think the situation is more complicated now.
That was Dionisio Pereira, head of the youth organization of the ruling PAIGC of Guinea-Bissau. You're speaking to Ricky Stryer from the capital, Bissau. Egyptian television broadcast video of lines in front of a few polling stations across the capital, Cairo, while many ordinary Egyptians expressed generally tepid interest in the election for a new upper house of parliament. That body was eliminated by Egypt's 2014 constitution, but it was reinstated last year by a popular referendum. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Voter turnout was mostly mixed at polling stations here in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, in a two-day election designed to resurrect an upper house of parliament that was eliminated by the country's 2014 constitution. Many Egyptians appeared less than enthusiastic about the operation, with some complaining the chamber will have little or no real power. Government supporters, however, say the body was conceived to play a mostly consultative role. Some candidates for the new Senate spoke to voters in person to get out the vote, while billboards and banners dotted the capital's urban landscape with photos and portraits of rival candidates. Most people went about business as usual amid the summer heat, with some telling VOA they planned to vote before polls closed Wednesday night. Government officials, including the president, prime minister, and other top officials, were filmed Tuesday casting their ballots on the first day of voting. More than 14,000 judges have been posted at polling stations across the country to supervise the election, while police and military have been deployed in strategic places to ensure voting takes place in relative safety. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that Egypt historically had a Senate until 1952, when the monarchy was overthrown. President Anwar Sadat, he notes, copied the U.S. Senate after a visit to Washington in 1980, calling it the Majlis Ashura. The body officially played an advisory role to parliament, while in practice rewarding loyalists with a post, Sadiq argues. The 2011 election got rid of it for being a waste of money. Historically, turnout has been low for the Shura Council or Senate. Sadek says the summer heat and COVID-19 will make for a low turnout this time around, too. Ahmed Gad, a former member of parliament under Islamist President Mohamed Morsi from 2011 to 2014, told Arab media the new Senate will be a carbon copy of former President Hosni Mubarak's Shura Council. He says the upper chamber of parliament was abolished in 2014 because it was a source of political spoils and a drain on government resources, and now the old system is being restored. Nearly 800 candidates are vying for 100 seats to be chosen directly in the new 300-member Senate. Almost 100 candidates alone are vying for 10 seats in Cairo. A second block of 100 seats will be apportioned to competing political parties, while the final 100 seats will be chosen by President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Dr. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA he hopes and wishes that Egypt's new upper house of parliament can move it forward to a better future. Egypt needs to accomplish much in order to reach its undeniable great potential, he argues. Preparations to sterilize polling stations due to COVID-19 did not appear to have a negative impact on voting, with efforts to make the voting process safe apparently successful. Election supervisors wore masks and surgical gloves while workers sprayed polling stations at regular intervals and distributed hand sanitizer to kill potential germs left on ballot boxes. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress, the ANC, says there is a political crisis in Zimbabwe which needs to be resolved by Africans. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently sent envoys to Zimbabwe to assess difficulties faced by President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government, accused by some Zimbabweans of gross human rights abuses. In an interview, the ANC's International Relations Committee chairperson, Lindiwe Zulu, who is also Social Development Minister, said there is urgent need to resolve the political crisis in Zimbabwe in an honest and frank manner.
The president is the one that will receive the report back from the envoys, because terms of reference are given by the president himself, as he is the president of the country. Remember, he is the president of both the ANC and the country. And from where we sit as an interfaithful relations subcommittee, the president will do what the president thinks is necessary for him to do from a government point of view.
So we still remember that you were once one of the people who went to Zimbabwe when then President Robert Mugabe was presiding over Zimbabwe, and there was a political crisis then, and now it seems as if there's also a political crisis in Zimbabwe. So as ANC, what is your view of the situation in Zimbabwe?
We've already said from an ANC point of view that there is a crisis in Zimbabwe that needs us from a party political angle as the Party Liberation Movement, ANC, Class ZANU PF Liberation Movement. It's important for us to engage with each other and go back to what has been happening in the past and how we got to where we are right now, and then be honest and be frank about what is it that we need to do to help the situation. Zimbabwe is our neighbor. We cannot close our ears and eyes to that. But what we think needs to be done is for both parties to be frank with each other about what is happening in Zimbabwe, and we take it from there.
So do you think that there's a solution in sight to what is happening?
Absolutely. There can never be a situation without a solution. It might be just the time, how long it takes for us to deal with it. This is Africa. We've always said as an ANC that as Africans, you must find solutions to African problems. And as a political party, it's our responsibility to continuously engage until we are comfortable with the situation there and feel that, you know, we are proud of what is happening, we are comfortable with what is happening. So engagement is almost synonymous with us as South Africa.
And that's it for this Thursday, August 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ray Key Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Border Crossings. The Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.